about the unity of thought and deed, the truth of idealism on Hegel Friedman, comes on the scene as an immediacy, indeed comes on the scene as opposed to history. Descartes' most obvious gesture. So it comes on the scene as a certainty and an immediacy. And hence is doomed to a certain sort of dogmatism. That although the whole project of reason is the demonstration or revelation of its claim to be in possession of the truth, because it abstracts itself from the history that forms us, and further therefore thinks that reason is abstractable from the history of its formation, and therefore believes that reason can be the possession of one individual as opposed to the communities that undergo the history that conduces to the formation of reason, for all those reasons, reason will end in a collapse. A dogmatism. I love saying dogmatism having a bell ring behind me. You're so right. I hope you notice I timed that. I waited. Yeah.
So, just to sort of put this in terms of the Kantian problem, if what we get at the beginning of the first critique is the two dangers of dogmatism and skepticism, then is Hegel saying, actually, skepticism thought in the Kantian mode ends up being a new dogmatism because it's not historical? Is that fair?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure. Because for... Hegel will say that spirit has three dimensions. Okay, spirit is we, that is, the I which is a we and the we which is an I. Spirit is history. And spirit is knowledge of itself in its history. All those can be found in paragraph 441. Just make them up. Now, reason, therefore, can be read as it shifts from we to I. We read it as an abstraction from spirit, which is what Hegel is saying it is. Then it reduces the we to an I. It reduces history to an immediacy, which is only possible on the basis of a forgetfulness. So in each of the three modes, so the abstraction is, as it were, very precisely defined.
So then this would also be this site of difference from Weber's neo-Kantian ethical individualism.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that would be just another individualism for Hegel, sure.
I mean, it would be this, okay.
Yeah, I mean...
Something you said earlier sounded a lot like Weber's ethical individualism. Was pointing to the strong difference, because I knew there was one coming up. And this would be...
Yeah, I mean, not all of these are false positions here.
Tricky because it's the problem of the way the historical moment is taken. No.
Say more.
I mean, that's why I brought up the Kant beginning thing. It's like Kant says, okay, we have to do philosophy now,
And we have this problem that we're either going to fall into these kinds of dogmatic system constructions or this sort of total relativism. And Weber is reconstructing that kind of problem again with sort of even more historical stuff. But the Hegelian critique would be, you don't see the historical constitution of the categories of division. So you think that you can stand outside and have this kind of critical position and not articulate your own way, your own thinking of the situation, what your genre is, sociology, critical philosophy, how that's constituted historically. So it's not really truly skeptical or something.
Well, that's right. And therefore, you know, there is not the notion of the vocation of the scholar, therefore, is not, as it were, this, you know, value choice amongst other possibilities, right? Which, of course, has nice neutrality. Yeah, no. As we will see, one of the scary things about Hegel is he is going to be able to be wanting to claim that ethics or morality is both objective but lacks all criteria. From here may sound just like saying anything sort of square circles. But that's the way he wants to play it. Okay, let me say something about the final moment of reason and say it just very, very, very briefly. Just to show you how we get, as it were, to spirit, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll begin talking about spirit. The last moment of reason is reason as a tester of laws. And as I've said before, what's being talked about here is Kant's notion of the categorical imperative, where the categorical imperative says a minimum necessary condition for any maxim of action to be permissible is that it be, one, that can be willed equally in the same way, in the same respect, by all. It's the principle of universality, universalization. And since that notion of universality looks like it's saying nothing more than like cases should be treated alike, and since we may say that to say like cases should be treated differently seems sheer arbitrariness, right? Then it looks as if Kant's asking after a minimal notion of consistency. He's asking what is consistency in action, and he's saying consistency in action must mean something like treating like cases alike. Well, treating like cases alike means, in practical terms, that people in like circumstances be able or capable of willing the same actions, just capable. They could, not that they do, or will, or even ought to, but they could. That's the question being asked. And then anything that fails that will show that the action is not a consistent one. That is, you're not being consistent with yourself, nor in allowing a relationship to others. and this is again rationalistic in a minimal way that seems hard for us to deny. Namely, what we're asking about any particular action is we are assuming that when we will an action, our wills are legislative. We're not merely doing something, but we're, as it were, instituting a norm of action. And the reason I say that is something that we shouldn't want to deny is that unless we have that view, that the meaning of individual action is that it is legislative, then I think the notion of individuality disappears. You look really puzzled. Is that all right? That's what I'm saying. The notion of self-determination requires that we think of each action as being legislative. Which is why, right, the real solipsistic relativist is incoherent. Right? Because they're so worried about individualism, right, that they can't see that what it is to be an individual is to be lawmaking. Otherwise, the notion that there is an individual, as opposed to being lost in the collective, loses coherence. Now, that notion that individual acts are legislative is one, in fact, that Hegel does not deny. Of course, he's not Nietzschean either, but he doesn't deny it. So, what is his objection to Kant, given that the way I've described it, what Kant is saying is seems so weak that it seems impossible to deny its validity. Hegel's answer seems to me a drop more subtle than it is usually portrayed as being. Hegel is not claiming, I want to be absolutely clear about this, that individual actions should not be consistent in a Kantian way. But if he's not denying that, what is he denying? What he's denying is that the moral law, categorical imperative, is the overriding and criterial notion for moral rightness. And the argument goes something like this. The example he gives is one of returning property you borrowed, or something like that. And this is one of the types of examples that Kant makes much ado about. And it's very simple to see why it works out very neatly for Kantian purposes. Namely, Kant says, well, look, say I promise falsely that I will return your records, okay, that I have no intention of doing so. Well, could that be moral? Kant says, well, let's look at it. If we imagine that everybody who borrowed things refused to return them, then people would stop lending them and the institution would break down. Ergo, I can consistently will that thought. And therefore, I'm committed to the idea that people's property ought to be returned to them. Hegel says that it's an illusion that it's the categorical imperative that is determining the goodness of returning property. It's an illusion because that we should return borrowed goods derives from an anterior commitment to private property, that people have rightful possession. But the categorical imperative will not tell us whether we ought to have a system of private property or not. So if we now alter the case a little bit and ask, what about the person who's starving to death? Is it okay for them to steal? Is it okay for the workers who are locked out to take over the boss's factory? Then the categorical imperative falls silent. It falls silent when the debate is between two particular forms of life. But, Hegel wants to say, a form of life in which there'd be no private property, and a form of life in which there would be private property. About the goodness or badness of those forms of life, it can tell us nothing. But we are most legislative as individuals, that is, we enter into our strongest moral self-consciousness in willing the structures of the forms of life we inhabit. That is, that's when I am truly legislative. Not in my individual action, but when I agree with everyone else, we're going to have a democratic society, or we're going to have a racist society, or we're going to have, a materialist society. In all those fundamental choices is when I'm truly legislative. But it's at the moment when I'm truly legislative, which determines the fundamental structures of the fundamental institutions of the society, that the categorical imperative between all the kinds of possibilities we may choose says nothing. But that it says nothing is not a matter of indifference for Hegel. And it's not a matter of indifference for Hegel because in making the categorical imperative absolute and authoritative for us, the categorical imperative necessarily puts out of play our dependence on the very fundamental arrangements and our allegiance to them as the constitutive ethical questions that we face. But if our will receives its maxims from arrangements of that kind, and is only truly legislative in willing such arrangements, then the categorical imperative procedure must in fact deprive us of our fundamental moral identity. And the moral constitution of our will. So it actively alienates us from our ethical substance. And it does so by pretending that our moral core is elsewhere, right? Pretends our moral core is in the categorical imperative and not in the collective acts of willing a particular form of life. So we may put it this way, the moral ought is indifferent to the substantial ends of the will. How individuals realize themselves in and through engaging in particular forms of social activity where part of the purpose of engaging those forms of social activity is to affirm, to give credence to those forms of activity themselves. That is, there's a relationship between our particular acts and the kind of institutions in which we embody in them, right? So in engaging in familial acts, we put ourselves in relationship to the institution of the family, right? And those of us who have problems with families ergo have to forego, right? So acts always have a double register. We both are pursuing particular ends that are permitted and opened up by various institutional practices, but in so doing, we are putting ourselves in relationship to those institutions themselves and affirming or denying them in various ways. And the Kantian procedure brackets the latter. But it's only from the latter that we have an ethical identity. So it is the contention that the categorical imperative is supremely authoritative for us, and not the requirement for consistency itself, to which Hegel objects. That's what Hegel means when, or the old thing, that Kant is a formalist and that the moral law has no content. That's what it amounts to. It amounts to a not direct but indirect challenge, because it's saying that something that is secondary is being made primary. Right? It's not an absolute denial of the Kantian position. It's denial of its absoluteness. Because, of course, once I do accept, say, private property, and I will a form of life in which that's the case, then stealing is wrong. Right? And it would be inconsistent both to want and to uphold a form of life in which we have private property and to espouse the goodness of stealing. But that's because, not because I'm an abstract moral agent, but because I've determined, historically but groundlessly, that as far as I can make out, the best form of life possible is one in which there is private property. I don't actually think that's true. Private property is confused. But that's the kind of thought that's required. And for that, there are no ultimate criteria. Okay. Which is to say what? It's to say that the content which the moral law espouses comes from elsewhere. The content, the force, that's always the big question. What's the real force of the moral law? Why does it really compel? And I've said, look, the compulsion doesn't derive from logicality. The compulsion, in the sense of feeling that rightness and willing to go along with it, comes from my anterior commitment to a particular form of life. So the content comes from something we have willed. The content willed, and what gives force to particular maxims and their universality, is something we have willed. But that's what Hegel means by spirit. So the truth of the moral law is that it gets all its content from collective forms of life. Hence, the ground of reason is spirit. And live with that word. Okay, let's have a break there. I'm going to ask you if there are questions. It's probably easier to think about questions with cigarette and nicotine and caffeine and sugar and all the other, you know, really wonderful things in life. And we'll start again in 10 or 15 minutes. As a matter of simple information, the best abstract description of the notion of spirit occurs in the middle of the chapter on reason, paragraphs 347 to 359. Broad terms, Hegel tells us that everything we've been looking at up to now is an abstraction from spirit, where spirit has, as I suggested, the three dimensions. That is one which there is a mutual determination between we and I. That is to say, in order to have an individual identity, you must equally have a social identity. That all individuation is a process of socialization. And that, therefore, every individual identity is simply a mode or form or a way of inhabiting a particular form of social life. Secondly, spirit is history, as Hegel says. These shapes, however, are distinguished from the previous ones by the fact that they are real spirits, actualities in the strictest sense of the word. Instead of being merely shapes of consciousness, are shapes of a world. So, roughly, all being is being in the world, and to be in the world is to be in some world. And to be in some world is to be in a world that is distinct from other worlds, both spatially and temporally, although for Hegel, spatial distance is not very significant. Which is to say that every fundamental element of which we ever become conscious is something that has been historically shaped and formed. That there are, as it were, whatever potentialities we may have for speaking a language or being socialized or whatever, the fundamental structures themselves all emerge and are articulated in historically and socially specific ways. Finally, although we haven't got there yet, spirit is knowledge of itself in its history. And that's what makes this chapter different from every other chapter. Every other chapter has been asking the question about what are the conditions of possibility, we might say, for self-possession. We went through the forms of consciousness, self-consciousness, reason, and discovered that the unity of thought and being is, which is the claim of reason, is only realized as its actuality in spirit. That reason gets its reality and content from spirit. So what's most real, and if I can use the old philosophical word, what is substance of the world is spirit. So what we are now coming to see, starting from where we have been, is that subject is substance, where substance is understood in terms of spirit. Hence, paragraphs 439-440, spirit being the substance and the universal, self-identical and abiding essence, is the unmoved, solid ground and standing point for the action of all, and it is their purpose and goal in itself of every self-conscious expressed in thought.
What paragraph is that?
439. I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah. Hard reading those three number digits, right? Now, it's very important when we hear and read these descriptions of spirit to realize he's using all the classical predicates applied to God. Spirit is the unmoved mover. Right? It is the unmoved solid ground and the starting point of the action of all. It is their purpose and goal. Right? Notice its purpose and goal. We are spirit, and spirit is our purpose and goal. Very Aristotelian formulation. Don't worry about cashing these out for the moment. I will come back to these at the very, very end of the text. He's just giving us a brief glimpse of a fundamental idealist claim. You notice now what Hegel seems to mean by idealism is simply that what is substance which at the beginning of the text was the ultimate matter of fact, the thing in itself, has now become spirit. So the relationship between subject and object has become subject's inhabitation of spiritual life. As the truth of what it is to be a human being, that our ground is spirit. As substance, spirit is unshaken, righteous self-identity. That is, the claim is, this is the sort of thing that people like Derrida and the like are going to be worried about, is that there's no authentic or rational outside the spirit. But as being for self, it is a fragmented being, self-sacrificing and benevolent, which each accomplishes his own work, rends asunder the universal being, and takes from it his own share. They seem to only do the law on Tuesdays and Thursday mornings. But
But he has a thing that doesn't actually cut anything. I think it's actually a very... I think it's a Kantian strategy to disrupt the Hegelian critique. You don't think that's right? Looks Kantian to me.
That's right. Moses puts him down.
Okay. Now, we as yet have no reason to buy any of this stuff about benevolent self-sacrificing. But again, the point of these claims, especially at this point in time, is to be provocative. Right? The absolute substance of the world is spirit, and spirit is going to be self-sacrificing and benevolent just like Jesus, and so on and so forth. I mean, come on. Right? He's trying to get his readers really worked up. Spirit is the self-supporting absolute real being. All previous shapes of consciousness are abstract forms of it. That was my fundamental claim here. That nothing has any reality independent of it. All these things have been abstractions based on, as we saw at the beginning of reason, on forgetting. They result from spirit analyzing itself, distinguishing its moment, and dwelling for a while with each. This isolating of those moments presupposes spirit itself and subsists therein. In other words, the isolation exists only in spirit, which is a concrete existence. And then he'll say things in those paragraphs I mentioned earlier, like spirit manifests itself in the laws and customs of a nation. Because those are the fundamental, we might say, shared linguistic and discursive practices that constitute any particular social formation as being this very social formation. Each has its own particularity. Now, having said all that, one might now ask the reasonable question, why doesn't Hegel just get on with it and tell us all about spirit? We've just discovered the truth, it's spirit. And you all look as bored as sin and think, well, this is all this work for this? Well, there's a problem, and you're right to feel there's a problem, namely that this claim about spirit is something that has no phenomenological reality. This is something that we as observers, in looking at Kantianism in a certain way, can, as it were, critically theorize. But the question is this: how could we come to experience the truth of our subjectivity, the truth of my subjectivity, as a spiritual one? Hence the third version, the third feature of spirit, that spirit is a knowledge of itself in its history, means that you're right to feel neutral, because all you've been offered is an abstraction shot from a pistol. You might as well be doing sociological theory, right? You know, we've been going through modes of sociological individualism, now we'll go through, you know, forms of sociological holism. You know? So this chapter, the chapter on spirit, must, as it were, provide us for the first time with a real history, which is the history of how we, who claim to have an insight into the truth, could have that insight. That is, we must provide a history of spirit, which will be a history of those moments within Western history through which and by means of which we as a culture are enabled to come to an insight about our own theoretical self-consciousness, which is to say that we must now provide a genealogy of ourselves and the condition of possibility of the insight which we have as idealists presumably accepted by our reading of the text up to here. So the question is now going to be, who are we? Because everything has been an abstraction from that, right? And reason is that abstraction because it thinks that you can ask the question about the fundamental ground for the possibility of experience in abstraction from the historical reality of your position. But if it turns out that spirit is the ground, that can't itself be said ahistorically and neutrally. And if you're doing the same, then it must be said in a mode in which asking about the possibility of that saying is the same as asking the question about who you are. And to ask the question about who you are is to ask the question of the history that formed and made you possible. Because that is who you are. So the chapter on spirit is going to track these modes that are going to allow an insight into spirit. And that's going to be my first claim. My first claim at the end is going to be that it's only that moment, the experience of the insight that we are spirit, that is going to be foundational, that makes spiritual insight and insight into the nature of spirit the same thing. That's a puzzling way of making what I want to claim is ethical insight and metaphysical insight are the same. There's no such thing. I mean, if Hegel has been objecting all along to pure theory and to pure metaphysics and to reason as observer and to the idea of the world as an object, then his philosophy cannot return to a form of mere spectatorial theorizing. But if that's the case, then the insights of his philosophy must themselves be experientially, in his sense of the word, afferent, grounded. That is, there must be some historical experience that we go through, which is an experience that we have as individuals into our social and historical predicament that yields an actual metaphysical insight. So I'm going to say that the idea of philosophical insight and the idea of having an ethical experience have to be united. Or we have dissolved the very terms of reference that we've been generating up till now. So we have to have a history. And that history is going to start where all such histories start, with ancient Greece, especially if you're German. And he says, spirit is the 441 now, spirit is the ethical life of a nation insofar as it is the immediate truth, the individual that is a world. It must advance to the consciousness of what it is immediately, must leave behind its behind it, I'll learn to read it, must leave behind it the beauty of ethical life, and by passing through a series of shapes, attain to a knowledge of itself. These shapes, however, are distinguished from the previous ones by the fact that they are real shapes of spirits, and so on. So, we're going to start with a form of spirit that is indeed spiritual, that is, a form in which individuals, and we're going to call this ethical life, Zitlakait, a form of life in which people do take what is concrete for them to be their form of life. And we are going to, and do so immediately and directly, and we're going to see how that immediate and direct understanding of oneself as constituted by the ethical laws that constitute the community will eventually fracture, because the cause is the interesting question. That's what we have to find out. But something's crazy about that immediacy.